It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The Wisconsin Supreme Court heard oral arguments this week in a case involving the state's nearly 50-year-old spill law as it relates to emerging harmful environmental contaminants, things like PFAS. That's a group of manufactured chemicals that have been used in industry and consumer products for decades.
The law requires a company to clean up and restore the affected area if it spills or discharges hazardous substances.
Attorneys representing Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce argued that the law can't force businesses to test for and clean up PFAS without first creating an administrative rule.
But an assistant district attorney representing the DNR said there's no doubt PFAS chemicals are hazardous. Let's listen.
It would greatly hamstring DNR's ability to protect public health and the environment. Harmful spills like Leather Rich's would not just vanish. Instead, they would remain in the environment unless and until DNR can promulgate rules.
Our position is that DNR has not previously regulated a broad category of emerging contaminants like it does here. That is a new interpretation, it is a changed interpretation, and it requires rulemaking so that the regulated community can know what's expected of it.
We dig in now on this case before the State High Court with Dave Strifling, Director of Marquette University Law School Water Law and Policy Initiative. Dave, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
At the heart of this case is Wisconsin's 1978 hazardous substance spill law. Can you take us into this law, what it is, and acquaint us with its history?
Sure. So the law essentially requires persons or companies who possess or control a hazardous substance to investigate it and clean it up. And historically, DNR has always enjoyed a certain amount of leeway or discretion in applying the law and determining exactly what it means to be a hazardous substance. And the issue here is that there's no list of hazardous substances. Hazardous substances are defined in the law in terms of what they can do, whether they can contribute, for example, to an increase in mortality or a risk to human health or a hazard to the environment. And the problem, of course, is that our understanding of those things changes over time, and also that almost anything can be a hazardous substance depending on the quantity that's discharged. So the question here is whether DNR is still going to enjoy that degree of flexibility in requiring cleanups or whether it's going to have to become a lot more regimented in terms of what it has to do.
When you look over the decades, has this law always been contentious, or did PFAS chemicals make it so now more in recent times?
Well, there's always been disputes over the particulars of a cleanup, but I think this is the first time, at least I'm aware of, that anyone has requested that DNR formally make administrative rules to determine what should go in that group of hazardous substances. Again, I think DNR has historically enjoyed some degree of discretion, and you can understand why. You know, when an environmental spill happens, you want an agency, I think, to be somewhat nimble in its ability to respond to that spill rather than having to take potentially years to promulgate an administrative rule to address it.
So Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the state's business lobby, filed this lawsuit against the DNR back in 2021, arguing the state doesn't provide sufficient guidance on how it categorizes PFAS chemicals. What stood out to you about each side's position in the oral arguments before the justices this week?
Right. Well, from the company's side, you can see why they were upset. There's an adage in the law that bad facts make bad law. And there is some frustration here, I think, on their part, that the case involved a dry cleaner that was undertaking a cleanup for more traditional pollutants. And in the course of the cleanup, DNR told the company that it would also require cleanup of PFAS. And there was some back and forth there. The dry cleaner ultimately backed out of the program. DNR continued to enforce it. And the dry cleaner, as you said, now backed by WMC, sued the DNR. So, you know, there's some sense here from the business side that the rules were changed on it in the middle of the cleanup or in midstream. While DNR is arguing, on the other hand, that, you know, hey, we just became aware of this. We think it needs to be cleaned up, and we're going to add this to your program. So You know, there's some policy arguments on both sides here, and it's difficult to predict exactly what the justices are going to do with this.
So how might this ruling affect people in Wisconsin affected by PFAS contamination? You know, in particular, the residents of French Island who have been on bottled water since 2021.
Well, absolutely. It could have a significant impact if the court holds that these DNR cleanups are unpromulgated administrative rules and that DNR has to go through a rulemaking process to identify PFAS as a hazardous substance. It could delay these cleanups by years, potentially. DNR has adopted standards for PFAS in drinking water and surface water, but not groundwater. So at a minimum, this decision is going to affect cleanups of groundwater and perhaps even more importantly, those pumping drinking water from groundwater, because at least as of yet, we don't have standards for PFAS in groundwater. Those hopefully are coming. I think both those in the legislature and DNR have said that they would like to address PFAS, but there's nothing on the books yet. So this could result in a significant delay in PFAS cleanups. And, you know, I want to be clear that this case isn't just about PFAS. It's about anything that the DNR wants to clean up. You know, one of the things that came up at oral argument before the court was that DNR has required cleanup of some substances that we normally wouldn't consider hazardous at sufficient quantities. So, for example, if you have a tanker truck of milk that's departing a dairy and is spilled into a stream, DNR has required cleanup for that. Now, nobody would consider milk a hazardous substance in the ordinary sense, but at a certain quantity, it becomes one when it's released into the environment. So this isn't just about PFAS. It's a much bigger case than that.
We are discussing a case in front of the Wisconsin Supreme Court involving the state's nearly 50-year-old spill law. Dave Strifling is with us, director of Marquette University Law School Water Law and Policy Initiative. I want to point to a moment in this hearing, and speaking first is Justice Jill Karofsky to attorney Delaney Brewer representing the plaintiff. Let's listen.
I didn't find an instance in your brief where you, in fact, disagreed that PFAS is a hazardous substance. Do you disagree with that?
We disagree that PFAS as a category is called a hazardous substance because the science on 9,000 compounds plus has not developed. And we footnoted that I don't have the specific site, but we absolutely raised that issue in our brief.
9,000 compounds plus has not been developed, the science on that. What is your response to that argument?
Well, I think it's certainly true that PFAS is a category of chemicals, and sometimes we're all a little bit loose in how we use that term. And there could be 10,000 or 15,000, depending on whose categorization you are using. But I think it just goes to how difficult it would be if we're going to require DNR to promulgate an administrative rule for every one of those compounds. I think that would be administratively impossible. I also think there's lots of science out there to show that PFAS as a category of compounds are harmful and toxic. So it's, I think, a pretty tough argument to make. It's difficult to say, in my opinion anyway, that PFAS haven't been shown to be harmful. There's quite a body of science that shows that they are. Again, if you want to break down to each one of the 9,000 compounds, certainly there will be differences in the effects that each one of them have. And again, if we're going to require DNR to do a rulemaking on each one of them, that would be pretty difficult.
Is it possible to make administrative rules in a timely fashion that are responsive to new and emerging scientific information and, you know, about chemical substances in our environment?
Yeah, I think the difficulty here is that for administrative rulemaking in Wisconsin, there are some additional hurdles that we don't see in every state. In some cases, there's approval required by the legislature. In other cases, the legislature can block administrative rules at its own discretion. So it's a process that is lengthy and spelled out in the administrative rules and the statutes for exactly how agencies have to go about doing that. And it's not just that we become aware of some chemical and we decide we want to regulate it. It's that there's an active spill happening here. And the effects of that can be felt within days, let alone months or years that it would take to promulgate a rule to address it. So again, you know, you're not just talking about PFAS, we're talking about ordinary compounds that can be hazardous at certain quantities. You're also talking about other emerging contaminants, pharmaceuticals, rocket fuel, cosmetics, microplastics, nanoparticles, you know, the list goes on and on of things that are in the environment that we're only just becoming aware of. So if DNR would have to make a rule to address each one of those things, and obviously you can break down those categories even further, that would be pretty difficult.
I want to take a look at just one example in recent times here with the spill law in action, and that's an oil spill, a crude oil spill, Enbridge Oil Pipeline, you know, that in Jefferson County, Enbridge submitted a report to federal regulators. 4 gallons of crude oil reaches groundwater. How could this state Supreme Court ruling decision impact a situation like a crude oil leak in Jefferson County?
Right. So DNR would certainly argue that crude oil is a hazardous substance as that term is defined in the statute. It's a hazard to human health. It's a hazard to the environment. And so DNR would certainly attempt to require a cleanup in that case. Now, if the Supreme Court rules against the state in this case that's going on right now, at least under the letter of the law, the company could argue that there hasn't been an effort by DNR to designate crude oil as a hazardous substance, to formally classify it as such. Now, I'm not saying the company would do that. I think it seems illogical to say that crude oil would not fit that definition. But depending on how the court drafts its opinion in this case, that could be one of the possible outcomes.
Dave, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure.
Dave Strifling is director of Marquette University Law School Water Law and Policy Initiative. He was with us to discuss oral arguments this week in a case before the state Supreme Court that could potentially change the DNR's ability to enforce the state's spill law and challenge the state's classification of what chemicals are considered hazardous substances.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, dig into the history of Black communities in Milwaukee and cities around the U.S. and how they built thriving local cultures and economies.
It was not easy. It was always done against the odds, but they did it.
That's coming up on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. For much of our country's history, Black Americans have had to forge their own way as they haven't been allowed the same rights and opportunities as white Americans. Quality housing, education, and jobs have been kept from Black people, often with the force of law.
A new book chronicles the history of Black Americans making lives for themselves in American cities in spite of the forces of institutional racism, building their own thriving communities and urban centers around the country, including Milwaukee.
Joe William Trotter is the Giant Eagle University Professor of History, Director of the Center for African American Urban Studies and the Economy at Carnegie Mellon University. His books include Black Milwaukee, The Making of an Industrial Proletariat. His most recent book is Building the Black City, The Transformation of American Life. And he's a graduate of Carthage College in Kenosha. Joe, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thank you.
Let's start with this concept of the Black City. As I read your book, it's almost a city within a city at so many points in American history. Can you talk a little bit about that concept?
Yes, that is a key point in writing this book, Building the Black City. Over the years, Black urban history has really blossomed into a major field, as you know, and it continues to grow. One of the things that is a major theme in the literature on African-American urban life is this notion of a city within a city. As early as 1945, St. Clair Drake and Horace R. Caton, sociologists and anthropologists, they actually employed the notion of a city within the city, and they pretty much defined it in physical, you know, terms, in geographical terms, as a pretty much a segregated space within the larger city, a place that Black people inhabited. So it's kind of a physical, you know, kind of definitional issue that they came to grips with. But of course, St. Clair Drake and Horace R. Caton also understood the city in cultural terms as well. And so they had that large part of the study called Bronzeville, in which they looked deeply into the African-American community and actually talked about churches, fraternal orders, businesses, newspapers, and so on. But the what's driving my notion of a city within the city is that too often, though, we sublimate the Black city within the city to other kinds of understandings of the city. And that is, as you know, this notion of a ghetto was many years a defining feature of the way historians went about talking about the Black urban experience. But even in the absence of using a ghetto, we still tend to look at the Black urban experience through the lens of inequalities and victimization. And I'm thinking about the importance of that today. As you know, as I started to write Building the Black City, the reparations movement really took off across the country and of course around the world, a global phenomenon. And when you talk about compensating Black people for past wrongs and the way in which they were deprived of their income, their land, their housing, and were really dispossessed, there's a way in which, you know, Blacks are treated in a kind of victimization approach that really highlights the case for reparation based upon these many, many forms of deprivation. But Building the Black City tries to turn things on its head and to say that we can still make a case for reparations without denying the what you may call the creativity of African Americans within those spaces that were discriminatory. And so Building the Black City tries to revamp and redirect our understanding of Black urban life around this notion that Black people didn't just wait for reparations to take place or for people to rectify past injustices. They went about building a city within the city to address their own needs. And so this book is all about the way Black people harness their resources, meager resources, to build churches, to build businesses, and to really craft a kind of internal social infrastructure, economic infrastructure that was designed to serve the needs of Black residents. And so this particular kind of approach to Black urban history, in a way, goes a little bit against the grain of the, what you might call the material analysis of the Black urban experience, in which you can see gross inequalities between Blacks and whites that was occasioned by class and racial discrimination. So it sort of flipped things over and help us to see that we can make the case for reparations in part on the basis that African Americans did so much with so little to help themselves, and that we shouldn't discount that and to overplay the notion of deprivation.
And that's reading the book. I really took that away from it. I have definitely heard that the stories of victimization by segregation, economic discrimination, the list goes on and on. And those are all real, of course. What is it, as you went from city to city, and you go through a lot of cities, including Milwaukee, what is it that inspired you to focus so much on that creativity you were just talking about and the ability of people to build so much in some cases with so little to start with?
Yes, thank you for that question. I was motivated by a number of factors. One of them is this whole idea that Black people build an urban environment. There's a tendency to treat that phenomenon as essentially a product of the Great Migration. You know, that Black people during the late 19th, early 20th century finally broke out of the rural South and moved increasingly into the urban environments within the South and across the nation, the North, West, and South. And so, in some ways, the way we've understood even the Black city in victimization terms has been to sort of centralize our understanding of Black urban life in this Great Migration era. Now, over the past several decades, we have gone a long ways towards showing that there was a significant Black urban presence in American cities from the colonial period through the early 21st century. And so in writing this book, I wanted to make sure that we connect the story of 20th century urban Blacks backward to the story of transatlantic slave era Blacks. And so that we can begin to see that Blacks, urbanites, were there from the beginning.
Well, we're here in Wisconsin, so if I may, I'd like to zoom in on the part of your book that deals with the Midwest, and if you could pick up with one of those eras you mentioned, when we saw this migration to cities across the Midwest, and you spend a lot of time in a whole other book actually looking at Milwaukee. Can you set the stage for us there?
Yeah, much of my conceptualization of the Black urban experience, as some of you know, was built initially on the way I was able to talk about the history of Black Milwaukee as a case study. And over the years, I've used Milwaukee as a kind of sounding board and comparative vantage point to talk about other places within the Midwest, but also in the Northeast, the South, and the West. And the Midwest, in many ways, is unique. In the context of the way Black people built cities. And one of the themes of the book that runs straight throughout the book is that we need to think about the Black city building process in all of its complexity, that it was not a simple process, that it was a process that varied significantly over time, but also from place to place. The Black city building process in the Midwest was a latecomer. In the Northeast, Black cities had their origins in the colonial period, along with the time frame of New Orleans, Charleston, Baltimore, and so on. And so in the Northeast, you see African-American developing a Black city, what I call a Black city during the colonial period. New York City, from the beginning, even under the Dutch, Black people had started to gain access to land. And so the city building process has always been a process of a settlement, getting a foothold, and then suffering some form of displacement and having to move to another locale, situate themselves in a different space, and then replicate that city infrastructure that they were able to build in previous locations. And in the Midwest, Milwaukee, Chicago, Detroit, all of these cities had their experience with establishing themselves in a locale early on and then moving to other places within the city to reestablish themselves. Because the East Side in Milwaukee was initially a location of a small Black settlement in the city, but the West Side gradually emerged, and especially on the impact of the Great Migration, and then you have Black people moving into that area and of Milwaukee.
We're talking to Carnegie Mellon history professor Joe William Trotter about his latest book, Building the Black City, The Transformation of American Life. I want to ask about business communities that came up in Black communities in Milwaukee and elsewhere in the Midwest, in some ways a parallel economy to the wider city. Can you talk about the importance of that?
My argument is that we have treated Black urbanites in a way as, you know, they are inhabitants of the city, but they are exploited inhabitants. And so the emphasis for the most part has been placed on the way they were segregated, exploited, and mistreated. And so that has put a damper on us understanding that, yes, that story is a centerpiece of the Black urban experience, but it is not the only piece. That process tend to overshadow the way in which Black people themselves saw themselves as actors in gaining access to land and also housing that they could use to actually build institutions in those areas. And so the notion of Black people as city builders ask us to look at strategies that Black people employed to stay in the city, for one thing. One of the parts of this study is that the city was not all that hospitable to Black people. So at one level, Black people were in many ways victims of efforts to remove them from the city, you know, to displace them from the city. So they had to fight for a place in the city. And they were able to do this by finding ways to rent property. Early on, they were able to rent property. And early on, some of them were able to find ways to buy property and then move on to chart the ways that they use their tenuous foothold in the housing structure of the city as renters and to some extent as owners. They begin to collaborate with each other to build their first churches, to build their first fraternal orders, to build their first barbershops and beauty shops. And we often underplay the degree to which African Americans are affecting the built environment of American cities through their own activities of building an infrastructure to serve their needs. And so this book is trying to revamp our whole way of thinking about the way Black people inhabit cities, the way they behave in cities, the way they build in cities. And so my whole point is that Black people were not just ghetto dwellers or occupants of the lowest housing cost market in the city. They were also truly city builders.
Something else that struck me is your talk about the political activism in these Midwestern cities. I think a lot of times in the United States, if you say civil rights movement, we think of the 1950s and 60s. Well, hang on. You're talking about people being very active on things like housing, access to public services, and a lot more. For example, in the post-World War I era in Milwaukee and Detroit and other Midwestern cities.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And the argument here and what I try to document in every city that I look at in this book is that Black people did not just build the city to occupy as housing and to go about their everyday lives, pretty content to do that. They actually use this infrastructure to mobilize politically. And so Black churches were not just religious institutions, they were political institutions. Fraternal orders were not just, organizations for friendly camaraderie between Blacks. It was also a political organization. And almost all of these institutions, including businesses, barbershops, beauty shops, played a role in all of the mobilizations that Black people developed. In every city across the country that I looked at, Black people did this against the odds. They faced tremendous pressure to give up on the city. And there were race riots in the 19th century and the 20th century. In some cases, Black people faced some physical violence in Milwaukee. They faced physical violence in Atlanta, riot of 1906, a terrible riot that destroyed thousands of dollars worth of property, schools, and homes in the city. And in Cincinnati, one of the most significant outbreaks of racial violence of Black people took place. And in each case, some Black people migrated to other places, but other Black people stayed and undertook the difficult task of rebuilding. you know, their communities. And this is what I call the dynamic of the Black city building process, that is very complicated. It was not easy. It was always done against the odds, but they did it. And we just haven't, I think, given them enough credit.
And we'll leave it there. Joe, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Joe William Trotter is a professor of history and director of the Center for African American Urban Studies and the Economy at Carnegie Mellon University. He's a graduate of Carthage College in Kenosha. He talked to us about his new book. It's called Building the Black City, The Transformation of American Life.
Join us Monday for a celebration of the life and legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. by tuning in to Wisconsin Public Radio's broadcast of Wisconsin's 45th annual tribute and ceremony from the Capitol Rotunda. The tribute is Wisconsin's official state ceremony and the oldest official MLK state celebration in the U.S.
The theme of this year's program is Justice Lives Here. The program is produced and hosted by Jonathan Overby, executive producer and host of The Road to Higher Ground.
The event in the state capitol rotunda is free and open to the public. It will be broadcast live at noon, January 20th on WPR music stations in Wisconsin, on WPR.org and the WPR app. You can also find it rebroadcast at 8 p.m. on January 20th on WPR news stations.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Winnebago Area Literacy Council in Oshkosh helps immigrants and refugees learn English and adjust to life in the U.S. The organization has a new executive director, Chu Mei Peng, who herself is an immigrant and learned English at a literacy center like the one she now leads.
The council serves more than 150 students from all around the world. Producer Colleen Leahy visited the center to talk with one of those students about her story.
Well, you can sit here.
It's 12:30 p.m. on a Monday. Time for the Winnebago Area Literacy Council's More English class. 14 students listen as teacher Jean Kyler gives a lesson on nouns. Today, the students are learning how to tell the difference between pronouns, common nouns, and proper nouns.
We have common nouns that are like boy, girl, city, lake.
As part of the lesson, Kyler lists all the places her students are from.
Everybody has a different country. Mexico, Turkey, Nicaragua, Haiti, Laos.
DRC.
DRC. Venezuela. Those are the proper nouns.
Yes.
The common noun is country.
Everyone has a piece of paper with a noun on it. Their task is to figure out if the noun is proper, common, or a pronoun. Elena Tichenko has been learning English at the Literacy Council for 1.5 years. She's sitting next to me.
Elena, what do you have?
November.
November. Proper noun. Proper noun. November.
Proper noun.
I asked Elena if she found learning English to be an annoying process. Her response was unequivocal.
No.
Yes.
Очень непросто.
To learn English.
I talked to Elena with the help of a translator named Oksana Martinova Przenka, who has also been working with Elena in the Literacy Center's Road to Work program.
За последние три года мне пришлось.
So, you know, it so happened in my life that in the past 3 years I have been learning three other languages, and English turned out to be the most challenging of them.
Wait, you're learning, what are the three other languages you're learning?
Какие другие, вот три основные языка, которые вы изучали?
Мы учили каталанский, испанский и французский.
Catalonian Spanish, Spanish, and French.
Like nearly 7 million other Ukrainians, Olena fled her country because of the Russian invasion. That's actually why she's had to learn so many languages.
It was really hard to leave my homeland. So there was bombing going everywhere. It was terrible. After our neighborhood and my house were bombed and pretty much deteriorated to the ground, so we first arrived into the refugee camp in Spain. So we were in that particular part of Spain where Catalonian Spanish, Spanish and French were all kind of merged together, and we were attending classes where we had to study the three of them. Really heartbreaking to leave my homeland because I lived there for 55 years of my life. So leaving everything behind was heartbreaking.
Olena has been living in Omro for 2 years. Her daughter came to Wisconsin first from Spain on a fiancé visa, and Olena followed her 6 months later via the Uniting for Ukraine program, which is also called U4U. The Biden administration launched U4U back in 2022 so that there'd be a simpler way for Ukrainians displaced by the war to come to the U.S. Omro is very different from Olena's hometown of Kharkov.
I have been living all my life in a 2 million, population-wise, 2 million people city, and now I came to Wisconsin, Oshkosh, Omro. So these are such small communities in comparison with my hometown that I feel that I feel I'm like on a deserted island. But if you cry out for help, somebody will run to the rescue.
Olena is happy in Omro, but she still struggles to find transportation to work and her ESL classes. She's also worried about what will happen in February, which is when her U4U visa expires.
Because initially, this U4U program was set up for 2 years, and after my parole expires, legally, I'm not sure how, with the new administration, it will work out so that I could reapply to legally stay in the United States.
Olena wants to stay in the U.S. permanently so she can enjoy her life and keep working. And she doesn't have a home or family to return to in Ukraine.
So having come to Wisconsin, I really felt I got into a very safe, calm environment. I love the nature here. It just feels so peaceful after those years of living, you know, under the threat of bombing, you know, every night, and the tragedy of the whole nation. I feel at peace here. I also find the citizens of this country very friendly, very supportive. Whoever I reach out to always lend me a helping hand. I really find them friendly, optimistic, resourceful, who are ready to share whatever they have.
For Wisconsin Today, I'm Colleen Leahy.
And thanks to Tyler Ditter on the technical direction for that story.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. Fishers in Douglas County are getting ready for the 58th annual Fisherama on Amnicon Lake.
It is a community ice fishing event to raise money for Tri-Lakes Community Center in Superior, which serves three lake communities, Amnicon, Dowling, and Lyman.
This is their third try at hosting the 58th event. Fisherama had to be canceled for the past 2 years because of poor weather and ice conditions.
We're joined now by two Fisherama organizers who are planning the event for February 1st. Judy Peterson is on the board of directors for the Tri-Lakes Community Center in Superior. Judy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
And Kathy Listall is here, board president for the Tri-Lakes Community Center. Kathy, welcome.
Thank you.
Kathy, let's start with you. How are you feeling about your prospects for Fisherama being a go this year?
Much more positive with the inches of ice that are on the lake and not a whole lot of snow. So hopefully it will be fairly warm out and sunny.
Oh, fingers crossed, right?
Yes.
This is the 58th Fisherama. Can you talk about a little bit about its origins, how it got started, how it has evolved over the years?
I don't know why it got started other than being a fundraiser for the community center. And I believe in 1965, that was the year that the community center first started the Fisherama. And over those years, I think there's only been three cancellations, two of them being just in 2023 and 2024.
Wow. And so what were those cancellations like, Kathy, last year and the year before?
Well, the first year was because of the huge amount of snow. Nobody could get on the lakes. And last year, because of the warm temperatures, the ice conditions were so unsafe that really nobody that had a Fisherama of any kind or a fishing contest even had a go for it.
Judy, what is the work that goes on in the background to put on Fisherama? What are some of those volunteers doing to get ready?
Oh my gosh. Well, there's a lot of things that happen prior. I mean, rounding up 30 volunteers, ordering food, collecting prizes for, we have drawings on the ice, getting all the paperwork organized. And then on the day of, it's really, we hit the ground running about 9-ish. It doesn't start till noon, but we have tents to set up, tables to set up, food trailers to set up, getting all the registration material ready. I mean, it's quite a production.
What do those ice fishers catch in Amnicon Lake?
Any legal fish is accepted. We have a category for panfish.
Northern.
Mm-hmm. And then any other legal fish. And we present a cash prize to the longest fish in each of those categories for adults, and then also the three categories for children.
Kathy, what does the community love about this event?
I think it's just the fun of getting together with a lot of people that they might not have seen for a while. Just all the good conversation and, you know, camaraderie, I guess.
It sounds like it really underscores, Judy, the mission of the Tri-Lakes Community Center, this mission toward creating friendships and cooperation. How do you view that through Fisherama?
Oh, I, like you said, it does. It does embody what we stand for. It's getting people together, having fun, something to do in the winter. So, I mean, people, I think they look forward to this every year. It's probably because it has been going on for so long, they really enjoy getting together for Fisherama. And not just ours, like Kathy mentioned, there are other fishing contests around. And, you know, people in the North Woods like having fishing contests.
Kathy, why has it been a struggle to find enough volunteers to put it on?
I would say probably number one, a lot of people are just so busy with their own personal lives, children, work. Some people have helped for a number of years and are getting much older and will not, because of health, will not be able to help out. And I would say that there are a handful of people that have helped in the last 8 or 10 years that just say, I want to back off for a year or two before I help again.
So a number of reasons. And have you been able to find enough volunteers, I would imagine, than this year?
Well, we have a skeleton crew in comparison to what we usually have, but I think that we will be able to pull it off.
Judy, this is a fundraiser. Can you talk about what Fisherama supports through the community center?
Boy, we do a number of gatherings. So community dinners, we donate to a number of organizations like the fire departments. We have scholarship funds where we give $2,000 scholarships to deserving students. And we have a huge fireworks 4th of July celebration every year. So any funds that we raise on all of our fundraising activities go towards supporting all of those activities.
With all of these activities, I noticed that the Tri-Lakes Community Center is quite the busy place. You hold about a dozen events through the year. How important are volunteers to making the community center work for everyone, Judy?
Well, that's pretty much how we operate. It's all volunteer, you know, even all the board members. I mean, nobody gets paid for anything. So it's just supported by volunteers who really believe that this is a good organization to have in our community because we are rural.
Kathy, what do you love about the community center?
I think that is a very safe place for people to come. We have a yoga and exercise group that meets on a daily basis. We have people that use the building for their own personal family get-togethers, scrapbooking, really anybody that's a member can use the building free of charge. And I guess just being able to have that socialization.
Will you two be ice fishing anytime soon or at Fisherama?
No, we'll be working.
And I hate to say this, but I don't fish.
The truth comes out. Oh, dear. Well, it has been such a pleasure talking with you both. And I do hope that Fisherama is so successful this year and you can pull off the 58th event.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we appreciate this.
And we're pretty optimistic. It's a goal this year.
That is Judy Peterson and Kathy Lizdahl. They serve on the board of directors for the Tri-Lakes Community Center in Superior. Their upcoming Fisherama, it is truly set for February 1st, and it's a fundraiser for the lake communities in rural Douglas County.
And we want to hear from you if you are an ice fishing fan, if you've ever been involved in a tournament like Fisherama or otherwise, or just like to get out for a relaxing couple few hours in your ice shack, let us know about it.
Tell us about your experiences and what you reel in, or share the story of the one that got away. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text us at 888-642-0232.
It can be hard to get financially back on track after the holiday shopping season frenzy and paying off the bills.
We've been checking out the online movement called No Spend January, where people resist the temptation to buy anything non-essential for an entire month, like no new clothes, no coffee runs, Rob, and no new restaurants.
We want to know, do you change your spending habits in the new year? Do you cut back on things? Do you reevaluate your budget? If so, how do you do that kind of overhaul? Share your tips, your stories.
Tell us about your approach to No Spend January, or is it maybe Modest Spend January? We'd love to incorporate your story in a future program. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. You can also call or text to get in touch with us at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.